Let me paint a familiar scene. You're lying in bed, it's warm, you're in a comfortable position, and just about to drift off to sleep, when... Ugh, how annoying is that? Suddenly, you're awake, swatting at your ear, fumbling around in the dark for the light switch, on the hunt for your miniature adversary, the invader of your semi-lucid slumber, the mosquito. I'm Joel Werner, and today on Off Track, we're taking on the bane of bushwalkers and urban dwellers alike, the mozzie. Cameron Webb is a medical entomologist. Every day, he works with bedbugs, houseflies, and of course, mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are Cameron's specialty. I catch up with Cameron at Westmead Hospital, about 45 minutes west of Sydney. Straight away, he takes me down to meet the mozzies, to a low-lit, warm, humid room with three rows of shelves. On each shelf, there's a series of boxes, each with fly-screen mesh walls. And all around us, a constant low humming noise.
Yeah, so we're in the insectary of medical entomology at Westmead Hospital. It's a special room where we house our insect colonies and do a lot of our experiments with the insects. So we have five species of mosquito here, and the mosquitoes we keep are species which are important pests or vectors of disease. So for instance, we have a freshwater species called Culex neurostris, and it's a major vector of Ross River and Balmer Forest virus, as well as Murray Valley encephalitis virus, so it's really significant in the Australian context. And we also have the dengue mosquito, Aedes aegypti. And the reason we keep that is not so much for doing work on dengue in our labs, but because that species is quite a voracious biter, and it's the gold standard for insect repellency tests internationally, so that's why we keep it in colony.
You've got five species here, but there are over 300 species in Australia. Most of them aren't really pests in the way we think of mosquitoes traditionally as being pests.
Yeah, that's right. Probably of those 300, there's only a dozen or so that represent pretty significant nuisance biting pests. And even those species that have been found to transmit virus to humans, some of those occur in such low population abundance that we're unlikely to get bitten by them all that often.
What are the practicalities of housing mosquitoes? Looking around, it's almost like the back of a vet's, but a vet's for small insects. I don't imagine it'd be easy to maintain. Can you talk me through the process of maintaining this population?
Well, the most important thing of all is the temperature. So currently it's around about sort of 26 to 28 degrees Celsius in here. We've got to artificially increase the humidity as well. So we're looking at somewhere between 70 to 80% humidity. And we want to keep it at these conditions year-round because mosquitoes are seasonal creatures, and so they don't like the cold, and so we need to keep them warm both so they can keep maintaining their life cycle, but also that we can rear them through at a reasonable pace as well. Mosquitoes have two components to their life cycle, an aquatic stage and a terrestrial stage, a flying stage if you like. When we're rearing through the colonies, we need to have trays of water, either fresh water for some species or salt water for others. And we rear them through, feeding them a mixture of brewer's yeast and fish food flakes, the same sort of stuff you'd feed your goldfish. At these sort of temperatures, the mosquitoes take about a week to 10 days to come through. They have four aquatic larval stages, and then they pupate, which is sort of like the mosquito version of a cocoon in a way. And they're little sort of tumbling critters in the water, and out of those come the adult mosquito. And then if we're diligent enough to make sure that all those pupae are removed and placed into a standard kind of mesh cage, about 30 centimetres cubed, the pupae will emerge as adults, and we can keep the colonies alive for up to 3 weeks just on a mixture of water and sugar solution.
I'm sure everyone's familiar with the idea, probably from repellent advertising, of people sticking their arms into a box full of mosquitoes. Is that how you test repellents here?
It is, actually. And there's a reason for that, is that there's a mystery surrounding exactly why mosquitoes bite. We know that the females require blood to develop their eggs, but there's a whole complex range of cues that the mosquito uses to when it determines when it's going to bite. So it might be the heat of the skin, maybe how hairy your arm is, but more importantly of all, it's the chemical cocktail on the skin. They've found about 300 or 400 different chemicals on the skin that can attract mosquitoes, and that complexity is incredibly difficult to reproduce either through computer modelling or synthetic means. So at the end of the day, if you're testing a repellent, sometimes the best way to do it is to put it on your arm and stick your arm in the cage. And that really is, internationally, is still kind of one of the main ways in which candidate repellents are tested.
It's really interesting you say that, because my wife swears that she gets bitten more frequently than I do, and I don't usually get bitten by mosquitoes. So that level, the chemical analysis of the skin, the level at which mosquitoes get attracted to people, is still quite an unknown.
Yeah, it is. Everybody differs in terms of how mosquitoes are attracted to them or the quantity. So there definitely are people who attract more mosquitoes than others. What exactly that is on each individual is still a bit up in the air, and there's plenty of people who are working on that. And their first thought is that, oh, well, one day we're going to have personalised insect repellents or something like that. But sometimes the most important aspect of that work is probably the other side of the coin. If we can isolate a suite of chemicals from our skin, which are the most attractive to mosquitoes, that would be fantastic lures in mosquito traps. Potentially, it might come a time where we don't need repellents because we have really super effective traps to collect mosquitoes. The one thing we have to remember in all of this, though, is that at the end of the day, mosquitoes love a warm, sweaty human that's pretty stinky. And I sort of often imagine it as sort of like a chocolate cake. If we were to walk into a room and there was all the ingredients of a chocolate cake laid out on a table, so you had the chocolate and the milk and the sugar and the flour, some of us would like individual components of that, but if they were all laid up next to a freshly baked, iced chocolate cake, that's kind of what we'd like a slice of, and it's the same with mosquitoes and humans. I mean, they're certainly more likely to take the whole package rather than one of those individual components. The other thing, too, we need to keep in mind is that there's two aspects here. There's not only how many mosquitoes are attracted to us, but there's also the way in which we react to the mosquito bite. And so the female mosquitoes are the ones that take a blood meal because they need the protein hit in the blood to develop their eggs. When she's taking a blood meal, she'll insert a nice big injection of saliva into the blood, basically to get the blood flowing more freely, more quickly. And in that saliva is a sort of complex range of chemicals and proteins and things which cause an allergic reaction on our skin. So the same way we all differ in environmental or food or plant type allergens, it's the same with mosquito saliva. So, you know, we could both be bitten by mosquitoes today. I know that I won't react very badly to them, but perhaps you will. And so it might give you the perception that you've been bitten by more mosquitoes, when in actual fact what you have is your more sensitive allergic reaction, if you like, to the saliva of the mosquitoes.
So Cameron, I live in the inner city and the backyard at my house is tiny, yet especially after a wet summer like this, I have so much trouble maintaining the mosquito population in my backyard. It's just if I leave the dog bowl open, mosquitoes will get into it, and then suddenly we'll have hundreds in our backyard. You deal with this problem on a much, much larger scale.
Yeah, no, that's right. One of the things that really interests me about mosquitoes is how fantastically well they've adapted to every type of aquatic environment you can imagine. So we've got 300 or so mosquito species in Australia, and each of those species is adapted to a particular ecological niche. So you've got mosquitoes that breed in highly saline rock pools on the coast, to snowmelt pools in the alpine region. Some of them are found in salty salt marsh and mangrove areas, and even the classic freshwater swamp type environments. But we've also got mosquitoes that are adapted to live quite close to humans. And so we've got like a suite of mosquitoes which are like the cockroach of the mosquito world. Historically, they might have bred in tree holes and leaf axles and things like that in the jungle or the forest. But they've kind of realised that as humans create junk around the house that holds water, they think, you know, this is not a bad place to live. There's water around the home, so they're, you know, got somewhere to breed, and there's always people and pets around for something to feed on. So even in the city, we've got these mosquitoes that breed in pot plant sources, bird baths, rainwater tanks, and even small plastic containers in your dog's water bowl. And that can be a pretty serious pest. But the big difference between those mosquitoes and the ones associated with our natural wetlands is the size of their population. For instance, when we're out collecting mosquitoes, We might collect dozens and dozens of these backyard mosquitoes, but we're collecting tens of thousands of those associated with the natural wetlands. And that's a big issue that I deal with, particularly since one of our major nuisance biting pests are associated with the estuarine wetlands of our coast. And population sizes are triggered by high tides and rainfall. And of course, everybody wants to live along the coast, and so as we expand our residential sort of areas, we're living closer and closer to these mosquitoes, and as a result we're seeing more and more impacts, not just on quality of life through nuisance biting impacts, but also the transmission of some of these disease-causing pathogens like Ross River virus and Burma forest virus.
For me to manage the backyard, it's really simple. You know, I turn over the bucket before it fills up with rainwater. What sort of process do you go through to manage this bigger area, to manage developments that are impinging on wetland areas?
Yeah, it's a really difficult problem to solve. On one end of the spectrum, we have a whole range of mosquito control agents, which are vastly improved from what we traditionally think of insect control, where it would be broad-scale use of some of these quite nasty insecticides. We have a couple of products which are much more environmentally sensitive. They target mosquitoes themselves. They can be applied with modern technologies to really reduce some of those non-target and the adverse environmental impacts. The problem is that that's an expensive process, and when it falls under the responsibility of our local councils, sometimes there aren't the financial resources available to it. We also need to be aware too that mosquitoes are an Australian native animal. They're part of the local wetland ecosystem, and we don't really understand what the significance of their role in that ecosystem is as well. So even though we've got products that might be able to successfully reduce the population abundance, we're not really sure what those knock-on ecological impacts might be. The other way to look at the coin is to work out the way and where we put people. And so in the same way we warn people about bushfire and flooding risks, there's an increasing sort of acknowledgement that mosquitoes are another environmental risk, and that we can design our new urban developments in a way that we can not completely remove any mosquito risk, but at least kind of minimise their impact. And that might be through building design, the layout of new urban developments, and the incorporation of things like buffer zones between known mosquito habitats and residential allotments.
You did some work up in the Hunter in terms of these plans for new developments. That was about 5 or 6 years ago now. How's that progressing?
It's pretty good. I mean, some of the work that I did around the Hunter area was acknowledging that mosquitoes don't adhere to local council boundaries. And that has always been the problem in the past, is that you can have some local councils in Australia who are really great, they're knowledgeable about mosquitoes. Others are less so for various reasons. And the Living with Mosquitoes group that I was involved in around the Hunter was really the first time in Australia we've pulled together 5 local councils. But not only the councils, but other stakeholder groups in the region as well. So we had state groups like the Catchment Management Authority, the Health Department, and even federal agencies like the Quarantine Inspection Service, where they have a role to play in terms of the ports and exotic mosquito incursions. And basically the big achievement through that group was that we were able to increase the awareness of mosquitoes and mosquito risks throughout that large area, and that can be then brought into both the approval process for urban developments, but also the ways in which we rehabilitate and construct new wetland areas. And so while it's difficult to get a handle on how much of an impact we've had on the incidence of disease, we certainly know there's been an increase in the awareness, both in terms of those stakeholders and also the wider community in that area.
Medical entomologist Dr. Cameron Webb. How do you keep mozzies at bay? Personal repellent? Mozzie coil? More importantly, does what you do work? That's coming up next here on Off Track, the scratch to RN's itch. I'm Joel Werner.
She's a little Aussie mozzie in her Aussie mozzie cozy, and she's looking for a posse on your unprotected skin. When she's finished her inspection, she will give you an injection, and you'll have an itch to show you where the Aussie mozzie's been. There's a great proliferation in the mozzie population. It's a constant irritation to us all. Yes, it's hard to feel affection when she heads in your direction, 'cause the little Aussie mozzie is out to get us all. You can hear her calming, buzzing and humming, but she's hard to see. Traveling incognito, here comes a mosquito with a stinger aimed at me. It's the female of the species that's biting us to pieces, 'cause the Aussie mozzie's brother doesn't bite at all.
Do not be fooled by Don Spencer's charming personification. Mosquitoes are pests. They're a nuisance, and most of the time we're either trying to keep them away from us or trying to kill them.
There's a great proliferation in the mozzie population. It's a constant irritation to us all. Yes, it's hard to feel affection when she heads in your direction, 'cause the little Aussie mozzie is out to get us all.
So when I go camping with my friends, we all have a favoured strategy to deal with mosquitoes at the campsite. So I love citronella candles, probably in as much because they smell nice as they repel mosquitoes. Friends of mine like those little mats that you can get that you heat with a candle that give off a vapour. A friend's even started breaking out the old mosquito coils, which are very nostalgic for me, having grown up on the south coast of New South Wales. What's the best? Who's right?
Well, look, all of you are sort of trying a whole range of strategies there. And sometimes it'll come down to your circumstance as to what works best. I guess there's a broad brushstroke description of a lot of these products. We know that botanical products like citronella don't do very well at keeping mosquitoes away.
I knew it. I'm going to edit that out.
The smoke probably plays just as much a role as keeping the mosquitoes away as the products they contain. When you go into the insect coils, again, there's been studies that have shown that they're probably not as effective as you might think of reducing the incidence of disease. Again, the smoke and the insecticide contained within those coils probably has a role to play, but it depends how sheltered you are and where you are. Like, if you're kind of on the veranda of a cabin on the edge of the wetland, perhaps you get some protection, but if you're in a more exposed area outside your tent, maybe it doesn't work so well. Probably the things on an outdoor situation that works well are some of those devices that heat a little impregnated pad. They've got a synthetic pyrethroid in there that actually will kill mosquitoes, and that's what you want. You don't want to just keep them away, you want to sort of kill them, and that can be effective. But again, it depends on the circumstances. If you're in an exposed area where there's a bit of wind flow and it disperses that product, at the end of the day, you either want to take down the route of physical protection by using a bed net or some of the topical repellents that you might use directly on your skin.
So if you were at a campsite, what would you choose?
Look, I think I'd be using just a topical repellent on my skin. One of the questions I'm most commonly asked by my friends who find out what I do for a living, they say, when are you people going to invent something that keeps mosquitoes away? And I say to them, look, there is. There's a product that's really cheap, it's widely available, it's not been shown to have any significant adverse impacts, and it's available on almost every grocery store shelf throughout Australia, and it's insect repellents. Products that contain diethyl toluamide, which is commonly known as DEET, was sort of discovered by the US military in the 50s, and it's really the gold standard for insect repellents internationally. It's probably saved millions and probably hundreds of millions of lives over the years since it's been developed. Even though it's used by millions and millions of people all over the world, the only case of really adverse health impacts are usually in case people drink it, or they get in their eyes, or perhaps you're a bit overzealous in the quantity of the product that you put on yourself, or perhaps young kids. But even a low dose, low smell, low irritant type formulation will keep mosquitoes away for at least a couple of hours. You know, it can be incredibly effective, and that's what I sort of always use.
So what's the mechanism by which the repellent works? Is this harking back to the conversation we had earlier about the mosquitoes being attracted to certain chemicals on the skin and masking those chemicals, or is it more something that the mosquitoes don't like that makes them not want to come anywhere near the skin in the first place?
Yeah, look, repellents fall into two categories. We've got the botanical products, so things like citronella and eucalyptus and melaleuca and all those sort of very fragrant essential oils. They work for a very short period of time, and it's the unpleasantness of them to the mosquitoes keeps them away. For the chemical repellents, particularly diethyl toluamide DEET, it sort of switches off the host-seeking and blood-feeding cues of the mosquito. So it is sort of like the old ads that you see on TV where someone sticks their arm in a cage of a mosquito and they become invisible. What happens is the mosquitoes aren't driven away from you. Their hunger is turned off. And I see it in the experiments that I do where you can tell the mosquito sort of knows that there might be something warm and blood-filled nearby, but they just won't bite. That's the way these products work. Now, we sort of, in some ways, haven't completely uncovered or unraveled the biological mechanism that happens in mosquitoes. But we know that if you're wearing these products, the mosquitoes won't bite.
So, Cameron, you're saying there's a product available that will keep mosquitoes away, and it's repellent, but there are so many different varieties of repellent. Tell us about the differences between them.
Yeah, there's no doubt you can be a little bit overwhelmed when you stand in front of the mosquito repellent rack at the supermarket or the pharmacy, because there's a whole range of products and different formulations as well. Look, at the end of the day, whether you're using a roll-on or an aerosol spray or a pump pack or a lotion, it doesn't really matter too much. It comes down to personal preference about how easily you can apply it. And the important thing about the repellents is that you need to apply it nice and evenly over the surface of the skin. You know, spraying it here or there won't keep the mosquitoes away. You need to sort of cover any areas of exposed skin with the product. So the best way to do that really is to apply it to your hands first and apply it very thinly over the skin, not as thick as you might do for sun cream, but make sure that all those exposed areas of the skin are covered.
And it's like sunscreen. I mean, you have 15 plus, 30 plus, 60 plus. You have different strengths of these repellents. I mean, what's better and how long do the best ones last for?
There's a misconception there that when people see the tropical strength type products on the shelf, that they think that that keeps more mosquitoes away than the low irritant products. In actual fact, the strength relates to the duration of protection. So if you have a low irritant type formulation that may only contain less than 10% of DEET, that'll give you a couple of hours protection, but it'll keep all the mosquitoes away for a couple of hours. If you use one of the tropical strength products, you'll keep all the mosquitoes away for maybe 6 or 8 hours. And to give you an example, when we do work in the lab, some of the citronella, eucalyptus type products keep the mosquitoes away for about 15 minutes. If I use a tropical strength repellent, I can get 15 hours protection. Now, that won't always be the case in the field, but what that means is that if people are going outside for just a couple of hours, like hang the clothes on the line or do some gardening or something like that, some of these low strength repellents would be perfectly fine for those activities. But if you're about to have a big hike up the coast or go fishing, then sometimes these tropical strength products are better used for those situations.
What are you working on at the moment? What's your lab's latest research?
Probably the area that's taking up most of my time at the moment is looking at the ways in which we can design urban development and land rezoning to reduce mosquito populations. In the same way, we might look at ways in which we can take the known mosquito fauna from a particular type of habitat and work with local authorities, mapping programs of different vegetation communities. We can work at areas of higher and relatively lower risk of both nuisance biting, impacts of mosquitoes, and also a disease risk. We're also interested, really, in how these urban developments might be creating mosquito habitats within them as well. So the most obvious one might be the construction of wetland or the rehabilitation of degraded wetland areas, and trying to work out ways in which we can both restore environmental health to the wetlands but not reduce the mosquito problem. We're also looking at ways in which we might be creating new mosquito habitats within our urban areas. So as we're becoming more conscious of water conservation, there's sort of elements of water-sensitive urban design, which include the installation of rainwater tanks, new ways to store water within and below residential developments. And we're kind of interested to know, how is this going to increase the risk of mosquitoes into the future, and importantly, mosquito-borne disease?
Medical entomologist Cameron Webb giving me the lowdown on mosquitoes. If you'd like to find out more, head to the Off Track website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off Track. There's a link to Cameron's repellent use guidelines on the site. While you're there, you can catch up on any shows you might have missed, check out the image galleries, or let me know what gets you off track. You can also subscribe to the Off Track podcast through iTunes or drop me an at reply via Twitter. I'm at Joel Werner. But that's all there is for this week. Here's some more Don Spencer to take us out. I'm Joel Werner. Have a good weekend.
Yes, It's hard to feel affection when she heads in your direction, 'cause the little Aussie Mozzie is out to get us all.